Well, hello all. My name is Paul Weber, and I am pleased to welcome you to the teleclass, Infection Prevention and Control in Home Care, Improving Your Program, Preventing Infections. Our speaker today wrote the book on this topic. Mary McGoldrick is a home care and hospice consultant for Home Health Systems, Inc. Mary began her home care career over 28 years ago as a home health aide, and in that time, she served in a myriad of capacities, including 5 years as the National Director of Clinical Services for over 100 home health and private duty agencies in 30 states in the United States. For the past 16 years, she has provided consultation and education on Joint Commission standards, infection prevention and control activities, patient safety, and performance improvement. Now, when I say that Mary wrote the book on infection prevention and control in home care, I mean that literally. She's the co-author of the first and the second editions of the book, Infection Control in Home Care and Hospice, which is an official APIC publication. She has really a huge number of publications to her name as well. She's a member of the editorial review board for the Journal of Infusion Nursing as well as the Home Healthcare Nurse Journal. Let me also acknowledge 3M and their support of this teleclass. We are really grateful to 3M for their ongoing support of teleclass education, and thank you very much to you folk. So now to present the teleclass, Infection Prevention and Control in Home Care, from beautiful St. Simons Island in Georgia, I am tremendously honored to be able to present Mary McGoldrick. Mary.
Thank you, Paul. Thank you so much for that nice introduction. Good afternoon, everyone, and welcome to this session on Infection Prevention and Control in Home Care. What we'll be talking about, one of the things that, as Paul was going through my background and sort of my bio, another perspective that I bring to this session today is I actually worked for the Joint Commission for almost 12 years as a home care and hospice surveyor. So as we're talking about some of the challenges and things that are unique to providing care in the home setting, I'll also be talking about some of the survey strategies that all of you can take in helping prepare for really any accreditation survey, but also most importantly, providing the best care that you can for your patients. Now, for any of you that have made home visits and have provided care in the home, you certainly know that it's very different than providing care in a healthcare facility and certainly presents some very unique challenges. So we'll be talking about those today. Next slide. To begin with, I'd like to just share with you a little bit of an overview about the home care industry, because there's many different components of that. The first is home infusion therapy providers, and those are typically pharmacy-based providers that perform sterile drug compounding of IV medications, and then the nurses will take, those are delivered out to the patient's homes, and then the home infusion nurses will go out and teach the patients and families how to set up and administer their IV infusions in the home setting. And really, this industry started back in the United States in the late 70s, and currently there are over 1,000 home infusion-based pharmacies in the United States. The second is home health care, and that's where you care is being provided in the home on an intermittent part-time basis, really where nurses, aides, social workers, rehab staff go out on just a visit base, go out, provide care, and then leave the patient's home, whereas private duty services, these services are typically provided 4 or more hours per day, and some of this care is being provided 24 hours a day by RNs and LPNs or aides providing some very advanced care to patients who may be ventilator dependent, whatever, but that's on more of a continuous basis in the home. Hospice services provide 4 different levels of palliative care and supportive services to terminally ill patients and their families. And about 40% of hospice care is actually provided in the patient's residence, with the other component being facility-based care. And the last component really are durable medical equipment providers, where they send out respiratory therapist technicians and delivery personnel who go out to patients' homes and set up and deliver medical equipment. And some of that can be as simple as ambulatory aids to ventilator equipment, beds, whatever. Next slide. Now, in looking at the infection risks, you know, these risks are typical of, you know, all care settings, but these are the types and treatments of procedures that are performed at home that place the patients at greatest risk for acquiring an infection. And you can see the list here. It's everything from central line, catheter care and maintenance, all the way down to wound care, where nurses and therapists may be going out to provide wound care to patients in their homes. Now, all of these treatments and procedures that are being performed in the home have typically been provided by CDC guidelines that were general for all healthcare settings. And it was actually back in 2006 with the publication of the CDC kickback guideline on management of MDROs in healthcare settings that home care was specifically mentioned and specific recommendations for care being provided in the home. Next slide. What I'd like to do at this point is just to give you a brief overview and talk about some of the challenges that are very unique to providing care in the home setting. Next slide. The first, that really the primary challenge in providing care in the home is that you know the staff really don't have any control over the caregiver, because as I mentioned, the nurses, therapists, aides, they're going out to the patient's home to teach the patients and their caregiver, their family, how to be independent, to provide self-care. And along with that, there are sometimes challenges, you know, language barriers. People are very stressed trying to learn how to manage all of these invasive devices in the home. You know, it presents a lot of different challenges on basically teaching lay people how to be healthcare professionals, if you will. So a big focus of this is on providing patient teaching. A lot of time is spent on teaching to get the patients and families to be independent in their care. Now, along with this, you know, in teaching the patient and family how to provide this care can sometimes come some inconsistency in patient care practices, you know, that can lead to breaches in infection control. So, you know, I can also tell you, though, too, it's not just the patients and families. I can tell you from being a surveyor for the Joint Commission for all those years that even sometimes, too, the nurses and other people going out in the home do have some breaches in infection control, and we'll talk about what some of those challenges are. Next slide. One of the challenges that you won't see in a healthcare facility is the environmental contamination that you will often see in patients' homes, unfortunately. So the CDC HCPCS guidelines for environmental infection control in healthcare facilities really can't be implemented in the home environment, especially the recommendations regarding environmental services. Some of the challenges that home care and hospice staff are presented with when they go out to provide care. Again, it's not a sterile environment. Many of the patients' homes that we go into are really quite contaminated, whether it be with human blood and body fluids from, you know, people who, you know, are incontinent, dressings, or I don't want to get too graphic here, but, you know, just dressings that are saturated. I could tell you there's been many a home visit that I have stood the entire visit and have not sat down just because of, you know, furniture that's soiled, whatever. And then there's certainly pet excrement that's in the homes where sometimes people allow their birds to fly free, or, you know, sometimes people are just too sick to take care of their animals too. So pet excrement can certainly be a challenge to providing care in the home environment. Next slide. Another challenge, too, again, not everybody lives in ideal situations, and sometimes the general lack of cleanliness in someone's home, especially the kitchen and bathroom, can make the patients more prone to developing an infection, especially, you know, where aides might need to go out and prepare meals in such, you know, a kitchen environment. People have to go out and set up IVs to self-infuse. And then sometimes there are the hoarders where you have challenges, and there's a little path that might go down to the patient's room where the nurses and therapists and aides need to go down to provide patient care. So again, these are not situations that you would find in a healthcare facility. Next slide. Another challenge is the lack of utilities and major appliances. Even in this day here in the United States, there are some people that don't have running water, where aides need to literally bring water to a patient's homes in jugs to bathe them and care for them. Lack of temperate climates, again, this impacts the storage of supplies that are in there. You know, some people don't have air conditioning, live in high crime areas, so they don't want to open their, you know, doors and windows. That can certainly present some challenges. And there are even people, too, that don't have or have limited or intermittent access to electricity, and that can impact storage of, you know, IV medication for refrigeration and food and such. Even major appliances like a washer and dryer for linens that may become soiled in the home, people may have limited access to laundry facilities to be able to clean the equipment. So when I work as a surveyor, I'm doing a mock survey for an organization, and I go out with the nurse to observe them providing care. I mean, we've been there. And so what I'm looking at is what type of modifications are the staff making in their care practices to do the very best job that they can to prevent the patient from getting an infection. So those are some of the challenges with that. Now, the next slide, here's my favorite, another unique challenge, are the patient's pets that reside with them in their residents. So pets, you know, they're actually one of my personal favorite parts of going to the home visits. Love to see everyone's pets, but sometimes they can present challenges from an infection control standpoint. Unrestrained pets. I can think of a home visit. I was out with a nurse setting up her very nice field to provide wound care, and the patient really wanted her cat with her in the room while she was getting wound care, and the curious cat kept trying to walk through. Finally, we just kicked the cat out, and the cat had to leave the room because she kept contaminating the field, and we'd have to start all over again. Also, too, I've been out on visits where a nurse is perhaps kneeling down to, draw patient's blood, and then you have dogs jumping on you. Again, you'd never have these things in healthcare facilities. So again, I think it's best to put uncaged animals away during any type of procedures so that no one is placed at risk for infection. Aggressive animals, again, is more of an infection control risk to the staff that are going out to provide care. I can't tell you the number of incident reports that I read for staff that are, you know, have dog bites, and it's usually the little dog sometimes too. They get very territorial, but again, that can be an infection control risk. Now, sometimes patients that are infected with MRSA, they can pass that on to their animals, especially their pets. And so I think what the most important learning point with this is pets can become colonized with MRSA. And, you know, most of us love animals. We always pet them on home visits. So it's not just as important to perform hand hygiene after patient contact, but also having contact with patients and their pets that reside in the home. And certainly pests such as, you know, fleas, flies, rats, rodents, roaches, oh my goodness, they're all can be a significant problem. And many of those are carriers of human pathogens. So I can tell you from my perspective, typically how these can be problematic is when the nurses and therapists are bringing their equipment and supplies into the home, if they're not managed properly, which we will talk about, that can contribute to pests being brought into other patients' homes. I can think of a home visit I made with a physical therapist in a very roach-infested home, had his bag on the floor, and they were just crawling in and out, and he zipped his bag, and I'm sure he left with a few in his bag to open them up at the next home and bring presents that I'm sure the patient and families weren't anticipating. So that certainly is an issue. Another, not that these are carriers of human pathogens, but bed bugs are also becoming an issue, especially in the Northeast in the United States and other areas. So let's talk a little bit about, we talked about some of the challenges, so let's talk about some of the storage and cleaning and disinfection of the equipment and supplies that are brought into the home. Now, I love this little this next cartoon. It's very old, but it really accurately portrays home care. It says, "My home health files are under the mat bin next to the coffee pot behind the uniform locker in the back seat," because that is so true. When you're out making home visits, your car basically becomes your office. And with that can bring some infection control issues that staff need to be alert to. Next slide. So let's talk about some of the storage of the equipment and supplies that are used by staff. So the staff, they really, you know, home care is provided 24 hours a day, 7 days a week in patients' homes. So we're not there that, you know, all that time, but the staff need to be prepared to go out and make visits. So typically what they'll do is this picture that's here is a typical, you know, nursing vehicle trunk where the staff bring their things out. But the storage conditions are an important element to keep sort of track of, because it's important that the packaging, all the items that are stored, that they don't become wet, torn, because there is a shelf life to these products. There's either an event related shelf life or also time event, which we'll talk about. But the event related, this is very important, especially when medical equipment and supplies are being stored in the trunk of a vehicle, that the vehicle may be in an area of the country that, you know, has heat extremes, if you will, because some of the gloves, Foley catheters, alcohol-based hand rub products, if these products are exposed to extreme heat, you know, the gloves start to stick together, and then they're going to have holes in them, and they're not going to serve as barriers as they are intended to. So it is important that the staff go through, they check their trunk stock, you know, rotate it frequently, and then they're inspecting this on a regular basis to make sure that the packaging is not torn, contaminated, anything like that. Now, the other component with the items that are stored in the trunk, next slide, are products that expire, because I can tell you when I go out on home visits with staff doing mock surveys for them, I always look at the trunks, and I'm looking for, you know, again, another component I'm looking for are the expired products, especially the alcohol-based hand rub. That's probably a very common one, and we all know how important that is. I can think of a home visit I went out on with a nurse, and she was providing wound care to a wound that was infected with MRSA, and this nurse did a beautiful job performing hand hygiene at the appropriate times, after glove removal, everything was wonderful. But at the end of the visit, I checked her alcohol-based hand rub, and guess what? It had been expired over a year. So it's important that these products that do have an expiration date, that they do not exceed the manufacturer's date that's set on there. So it's important to check, you know, blood tubes, you know, typically fleets, wound care supplies, to check them on a regular basis. Next slide. Another unique aspect of providing care in the home is that the nurses actually bring their equipment and supplies that they need to provide patient care in a bag with them, and you can see a picture. It's a very typical nursing bag. Now, this is one of those things where you should have a policy in place, and the staff should be following the policy that you've set, because that's what any potential surveyor would be looking for. But we would be looking to see that the nursing bag, that it's placed on a clean, dry surface in the home, If your policy requires you to use a surface barrier, make sure that that is an impermeable one. Now, a barrier is not required. It's a nice to do, but it's not something that, you know, is absolutely mandatory. We'll talk in just a minute, but cleaning these bags, both the inside and the outside, is very important, as is performing hand hygiene prior to, because typically what I'll see is a nurse will be in the middle of care, they'll have gloves on, might be in the middle of a dressing change, and they go, oh, I forgot something. And they have to go back in their bag, and they go back in with soiled gloves, and guess what? They've contaminated everything. So it is important that the bag is placed you know, in just a clean area. Now, this is a non-critical item. This item will never have direct contact with the patient, I can't imagine. So what's most important with managing the bag and the supplies is hand hygiene, because that's where the hands become transiently colonized, you know, or contaminated, and then having direct contact, it's important that hand hygiene be performed prior to having direct contact with the patient. Next slide. The equipment that's brought out into the home that the staff use is typically really assessment equipment, you know, blood pressure cuffs, stethoscopes, pulse oximeters. It's basically non-critical items. The only semi-critical would be perhaps an oral thermometer that might be used. But it is important that the organization have a policy in place as to how often and when and, you know, and with what product this equipment is going to be cleaned with. Now, you know, if you look at the CDC guidelines, it has to be cleaned on a regular basis and if it becomes visibly soiled. Now, with home care, what's a little bit different, it's very easy for the staff to, after they do, you know, perform their assessment activities, to put the equipment down, and while they're talking with the patient, how'd you sleep last night, whatever, to be wiping off and disinfecting their assessment equipment prior to putting that back in their bag. But it is important that they understand when they're supposed to clean and disinfect the equipment, with what product, and the required contact time and the frequency. But that is also, that's basically going to be driven by the organization's policy. So it is important that they, you know, that it is cleaned on a regular basis and when visibly soiled. The one thing I also want to mention about this, though, too, is the product that's using, that staff use in the home. Sometimes they don't like these larger containers of disinfectant wipes that their employer provides to them, so they take them out and they just take a few of them and they put them in a baggie that's not labeled, and then they use that to wipe. Well, you can't do that. You can't be taking those products and placing them in a secondary container because it's not properly labeled. And so I just want to mention that, but definitely pay very close attention to cleaning and disinfecting the equipment that is used in assessing the patient. Now, another type of equipment, there's a lot of electronic equipment. Many of the organizations that provide home care and hospice services are very sophisticated. The nurses bring out laptops, smartphones. There's lots of electronic equipment that's there in the home, and they document their care as they're providing that. So it would be important that that's wiped off, preferably daily, and to clean that. But again, what's most important is if they're going to their keyboard and their laptop prior to having direct patient contact, that they disinfect, if they perform hand hygiene. Because again, that's how the organisms are going to be transmitted to the patient. Next slide. Now, there's a very interesting study, a very small study, but an interesting and sort of first of its kind for home care, that looked at the direct relationship between infection control practices as they relate to the bags that are brought into the homes, and to look at contamination rates. And if you look at this, the outside of the bags, 83% were positive for human pathogens, and almost 16% were MDROs. And now, to give you a little bit of background as to the size of this, Cultures were done on both the inside and the outside. They cultured 126 nurses' bags from four home health agencies over 19 months. So that's sort of the size of the study that was done. But you can see, look at these huge contamination rates. So again, the bag is never going to have direct contact. So it is very important that the staff do clean their bag, the inside, the outside, on a regular basis. But also, too, look at the contamination rates of the patient care equipment. You know, the blood pressure cuffs, stethoscopes, everything, these are very significant, again. In home care, it's very easy to disinfect the equipment after patient use and prior to putting that in the bag, and that would certainly, hopefully, reduce some of these numbers, if you will. So, okay, moving along to talking about hand hygiene, which is certainly the most important, as we're talking about cleaning, the most important cleaning process to make sure that hand hygiene is performed in the home setting, as in all care settings. So let's just skip down to the slide that talks about hand hygiene and using the patient's hand hygiene supplies. Now, there's no rule that says that the staff cannot use the patient's supplies that are in the home, but there are some challenges to that. For example, if a staff member is going to be using the staff's the patient's hand hygiene supplies that are in the home, I have seen nurses, you know, reach into shower stalls after someone took a shower and use the bar soap and perform hand hygiene and then go in and perform wound care. That's probably not best practice. So it is important that they do bring their own alcohol-based hand rub product, antibacterial soap. I could cite so many examples of, you know, process failures from a hand hygiene perspective, but in the interest of time, I won't go through all those, but there are lots of challenges with that. So just my recommendation is for the staff to bring their own equipment and supplies into the home. But certainly understanding the length of time that they're supposed to be, you know, washing their hands with soap, minimum at least of 15 seconds, and then with the alcohol-based hand rub product. Another challenge, too, of using the patient's hand hygiene supplies is many of them have those fancy decanters of where they store their soap in the home, and, you know, the CDC guidelines state that, any container should be emptied, washed, and dried before it's refilled and not topped off. And I can tell you that many of the patients that we see, they're just topping those off. So, again, they're not following refill technique. The home care staff typically bring out their paper towels or trifold towels into the home to dry their hands, but I can't tell you the number of times that I have seen staff do such a nice job performing hand hygiene, a really good job, and then they go from the patient's sink, they reach over, and then they dry their hands on the family towel that's been sitting there for God knows how long, and then have just recontaminated their hands. So again, it's important that I think for the staff to use their own supplies that are brought out that they keep in their bag with them. Now the next slide, looking at alcohol-based hand rub, we talked about the storage. It's important that the alcohol-based hand rub product is not stored for an extended period of time that would exceed the manufacturer's guidelines, and it's typically, you know, over 105 degrees, whatever. Because sometimes when I go out to people's cars to review their supplies, you can see the plastic containers, they're all swollen and they look like they're about to expand. So again, that indicates right off the bat this product has not been properly stored. We talked about expiration dates. Please, check those very carefully. Now, when I'm with staff, I also ask them, so, you know, this is great that you're routinely using this alcohol-based hand rub product, but tell me when you would not use this product. When would be an indication for you to use soap and water? So I'm looking to see that they understand the process would be of when their hands are visibly soiled, you know, with blood, body fluids, or if a patient has C. difficile. Now, I do see frequently organizations being written up on different surveys by different organizations for their application technique in applying the alcohol-based hand rub product, that it's important that the product be applied to all surfaces of the hands and especially in between the fingers. That's usually the one where it's missing, and that the staff are also waiting to put their gloves on to have direct contact until the product is dry on their hands so that the organisms can be effectively cleaned. And also, I've seen people, they put the alcohol-based hand rub product in their hand, and then they go to the sink and they use that product to wash their hands with soap and water, and obviously that would not be effective. Now, because hand hygiene is so important, the Joint Commission back in, which is an accrediting body, which accredits, you know, all healthcare organizations, including home care and hospice, back in 2004, they started with their national patient safety goals and having a stronger focus and initiative for staff to perform hand hygiene. And I can tell you, it is, again, since 2004, we're now moving into 2011, and it is still a problem and will continue to be a national patient safety goal, which means that during any accrediting body survey, that will be a heavily focused area for the surveyor. So they will be looking very closely at all of the implementation techniques by the staff and looking to see that the appropriate guidelines, whether they be World Health Organization or CDC, are being appropriately implemented in the field. And along with that, that the organization is establishing goals for hand hygiene compliance. And there is a hand hygiene compliance tool specific to home care and hospice on my website, which is homecareandhospice.com in case you are interested. But then if your goals as an organization are not being met, the action plans are established for making sure that staff are. So I can tell you again that the typical problem, staff are not washing their hands for 15 seconds, they're not performing hand hygiene after glove removal, and we talked about some of the other issues. Now, next slide, isolation precautions is another challenge in home care. On the next slide, you see the signage there for contact precautions. You know, you walk up to a patient's room in a healthcare facility, and there are usually visual cues and indicators of what type of isolation precautions need to be followed. But in the home, we don't have those. You're not going to know that. And so it is important that the staff are very familiar with the different types. And if you look to the next slide, the types of isolation precautions that would be followed would be, of course, always standard precautions, but perhaps in addition to standard precautions, the transmission-based precautions of droplet or contact, and then a modified airborne. Because I haven't been to a patient's house yet in all these years, anybody that had a negative pressure room in their house, so they would be more of a modified version. But what I would like to talk about for a moment are the managing of MDROs for patients in the home. So if you go to the next slide, in home care and hospice, standard precautions are really what needs to be followed for patients that are either colonized or infected with an MDRO. Now, there are certain circumstances, again, this is different in home care than it is in other facilities. Contact precautions do not have to be implemented routinely in home care, but they may need to be. For example, if you have any patients that have any uncontrolled drainage or secretions, you know, they're not following proper hand hygiene, their environment's contaminated, you know, those are going to be indications of when contact precautions would really need to be followed by the staff in the home. Now, next slide, the equipment, again, that's going to be brought into the home. We talked about the assessment equipment in the bag. If you know that a patient is infected or colonized with an MDRO, it really would be best for the staff to not even bring the bag, just bring in the minimal supplies and equipment that they might need. Or the other thing that's commonly done is dedicated equipment, meaning like a blood pressure cuff, stethoscope, is brought into the home, either disposable equipment or regular equipment, and it's meticulously cleaned and disinfected after the patient's going to be discharged and it needs to be brought out of the home. So again, just minimal equipment and really focusing the education with the patient and family on hand hygiene and just the basic strategies that they can take to prevent the transmission of these organisms. Now, it might also be best to, if possible, it's not always, but just as a suggestion, it might be best to perhaps schedule those patients at the end of the day as the last visit of the day. But really, if the staff are doing a very good job with their hand hygiene and following standard and, if applicable, contact precautions, that really is not needed, but just something for you to consider. Now, medical waste is also generated during the course of providing care in the home. So let's talk a little bit about that. The types of medical waste that's typically generated in home care are medical waste, and that's really going to be, I don't see this that common, but it would have to be a very blood-soaked dressing. It's not that common. Sometimes there is some pleural fluid. Again, that would be a body fluid that would need to be appropriately managed in the home. But I would say that most commonly it's sharps that are generated, that when the staff are, using sharps in the home, giving an injection, checking a blood sugar, whatever, it is expected that they use a sharps container to properly dispose of them. So the staff have these sharps containers in their trunk, or they might, if it's high volume, they might just leave that in the patient's home, but that does need to be properly placed in a sharps container, just as it would as if it was in a healthcare facility. Next slide. Now, after the medical waste is generated, you can see in the slide here a nurse on this particular home visit went out and drew blood, and you can see the blood tube is actually in the plastic bag, and then it's being placed in another impervious container to be transferred and transported to a lab. So this is typically transported in the back of the nurse's trunk. They carry in the sharps container or the transport container and then bring that into the lab. Now, blood and body fluid spill management, there's no housekeeping department to call, in home care, so it's important that the staff do have access to spill kits that in the event that they might need to clean a blood or body fluid spill. I can tell you that it's very uncommon, but sometimes that is something that has to be dealt with, especially in hospice patients as they are at end of life. On next slide, there are some risks. There's a study done looking at the risks for the staff being occupationally exposed to percutaneous injuries. And you can see that there is a higher rate of percutaneous injuries in the home health care workers. One of the things, though, that I do want to mention, and you wouldn't think that we would still have the problem today, almost 10 years after the OSHA Needle Stick Safety and Prevention Act was implemented, but I can't tell you the number of organizations that I go to or go out on home visits where the staff are still using non-safety needles. So again, I think it's very important that the staff go through their office inventory, their trunk inventory, and make sure that they are not there and that they are only using safety needles, because that is a risk for them. Now, on the next slide, there was an OSHA publication that came out actually January of 2010. It's a very interesting review talking about occupational hazards in home health care, because providing care in the home is very different. And again, some of these can lead to exposure to needle stick injuries or bloodborne pathogens. And some of it is just with the stress and the environment, going into homes where, there may be very strong odors, or say you're not a smoker, but everybody else in the house does, or again, traveling out by yourself to very high crime areas, going into homes where people who may be drug or alcohol impaired, the guns sitting on the coffee table. I mean, it's not the typical environment that you may have. And again, there are risks that are associated with that. Now, the last section that I would like to just talk about briefly is a little bit about surveillance. Now, one of the challenges, if you look at the slide that says lack of designated infection preventionist, that is one of the challenges. That's actually a Joint Commission requirement for organizations that are Joint Commission accredited. Your typical home care organization does not have anybody that is dedicated to really manage this function on, you know, a regular ongoing basis. To be honest with you, it's usually someone who's a director of nursing that it is their responsibility to, you know, manage the PI, you know, coordinate the care. And then we also throw infection control on them too, that's their responsibility to, you know, perform risk assessments and to manage this whole process. For organizations that are hospital-based, you know, they have other resources that are available to them and other outside expertise to, you know, have someone to go to ask questions and, you know, how do we manage this in the home? Where home care, you know, does not have that. So that really can be a challenge. Another one of the challenges in home care is lack of a surveillance database. There really is no data per se where organizations can go to compare, you know, their infection outcomes with other home care organizations. Now, for larger home care organizations, that can be done where perhaps they're benchmarking with each other and using their, you know, comparing their outcomes to, you know, their other similar organizations. But if in looking at other, you know, multiple freestanding home health care providers, there really isn't anybody that they can you know, benchmark with. Another one of the challenges, though, too, in looking at surveillance data is it's different than acute care because when you're looking at perhaps, you know, central line associated bloodstream infections, there might be family members who are flushing those catheters on a regular basis, or they may have been taught how to perform, you know, dressing changes. So there's multiple providers of providing care, or patients may be going to a wound care clinic or, you know, receiving outpatient chemotherapy, that there are other individuals and healthcare providers who are, you know, having access to the patients who could also be contributing to a healthcare-associated infection. So that really is one of the challenges with that. So in order to look at, though, you know, what type of surveillance activities the staff are going to be following, it would be important for them to begin with doing a risk assessment and looking at their overall program evaluation. Now, that could be a whole other one-hour discussion onto itself. But a geographic risk assessment, looking at the community, the patient population served, the types and treatments and procedures that are being performed. But I would advise you to really focus on the areas where the staff are having hands-on patient care and may be directly contributing to a healthcare-associated infection. So that would perhaps be one of the areas that you may want to specifically target on. For example, like I talked about, a central line associated bloodstream infection, collecting that data, making sure that it's being analyzed based on catheter days. Now, when you look at some of the surveillance data that's been out there, it was back in 2008 when APIC and CDC came out and published infection surveillance definitions for home health care and the home hospice market. So since that time, so since 2008, home care and hospice providers have, you know, consistently been using those surveillance definitions. So it's important to note that when you're reviewing studies and looking at surveillance data that's been published perhaps prior to 2008, the problem was that everybody was using different surveillance definitions and criteria. So comparing surveillance data in home care prior to 2008, you're not necessarily comparing apples and apples. So it is important that home care and hospice providers use consistent definitions. And again, I would strongly support using the APIC, CDC, HCPCS surveillance definitions and then publishing this data so that, you know, we do have other information where we can look at other practices and improve the patient care that's being provided in the home. Now, in looking at your overall infection control program, it is important that it be based on science and evidence-based practices and that there are sound policies and procedures in place. Now, these are the bulleted items that are here on the slide that talk about infection prevention policies and procedures. These are all of the topics that really should be in your infection control policies and procedures. And again, if you're interested, you can go to homecareandhospice.com, and there are some outlines and some things that would be available for your review. So making sure that your policies are consistently updated and having a complete set and that those are accessible to staff and that they know how to implement them, that's very important. So in summary, we've talked all about some of the different challenges that are unique, very unique to providing care in a home care setting, and talked about some of the ways, some of the problems that I see on mock surveys and observing in other organizations' surveys. So I hope that you can learn from these and better improve your patient care practices in the home care setting. I can tell you that the home care and hospice staff, they're, you know, a tough breed that go out there. They're not working under the best conditions. It's very different, but you know what? They do such a good job, you know, doing the very best that they can to manage their patients and really keep the patients where they want to be in their home and keeping them in a very safe area. So as Dorothy would say, you know, there's no place like home. So I hope that you found this teleclass helpful, and I wish you the very best. Thank you very much.
Mary, thank you very much. It's a fascinating topic, and unfortunately, it doesn't get a lot of coverage, even in the teleclass education series. But infection control in a home care setting is unlike any other setting, really, in terms of healthcare. I can't imagine any nursing home or hospital worker having to go into a room where there is drugs or a weapon on the table and having to just perform healthcare as normal. It's remarkable what home health care providers have to do. They're a group of people unlike any other. Let's just put it that way.
I agree. They're wonderful, absolutely wonderful, doing a very good job under what are sometimes not the best circumstances.
Shocking, that's right.
Yeah.
Your website is very interesting. I had some time to browse, and I found some really interesting stuff there. And the teleclass education program doesn't endorse or promote any particular product, but you had some really interesting infection prevention and control products there specifically for home care, and I would encourage people to at least go and look at those on the website that's noted on the slide there. Also, I presume, Mary, that if people have questions, it would be okay if they contacted you directly?
Yes, absolutely, and probably email would be the best way to contact me. And so my email address is Mary, M-A-R-Y, at homecareandhospice.com, and is spelled out A-N-D. So that really would be the best way to reach me, and I'd be happy to follow through and answer any questions that they may have.
Very good. Thank you. Thank you to 3M for their sponsorship of this teleclass, and for the great work that they do in infection prevention and control education. And Mary, thanks to you again. Hopefully this won't be the last time we hear from you. This was a really interesting topic, and I'm hoping you'll be willing and able to join us again.
Thank you.
To all, thank you very much, and we'll talk again soon. Goodbye.